Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, folks, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yeah, it's the tornado, Tony Pennycow.
And we're going to leave the psychic predictions to Tom from now on, because my Bruins prediction didn't work out. But we'll have Tom on in a minute here, I'm sure. We have a very special guest tonight, professional middleweight boxer Hector Camacho Jr.
This is only coming off a few months after he lost his father. And I know we've said on the show time in the past, I was never a big Hector Camacho fan, senior. But I did respect his skills, and it's always a tragedy when, somebody makes bad choices in life. He did. It was, drive-by shooting in his native Puerto Rico that claimed his life. And I actually saw Hector Jr. fight live back in 1999 down in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on the David Reed, Kevin Kelly undercard. And he fought a guy by the name of Mike Cooley, Mike the Hammer Cooley. And Camacho tore him up pretty bad in two rounds. And we saw Cooley walking out of there while we bumped into him in the morning. He didn't really talk to him, but he was lumped up, bad. And I remember I was there with a couple of colleagues of mine at the time, and we were calling him instead of the Hammer, we were calling him the Hammered.
Well, he's coming up against a big fight with Irishman Lee Murtaugh. And we'll have to ask him about how he's getting ready for that. I know that he's got a lot of fights under his belt. He's one of those guys who's he's already compiled 50 wins, which is pretty tough to do in this day and age. But even Floyd Mayweather is not going to have 50 wins by the time he retires, according to him. He's going to end up 50 wins every one of his last two fights here. He's going to only have 49. So I'll have to talk to him a little bit about that and whatever else we can get out of him. He's going to start hanging out with us at about 8:30. We got Tom. Tom is live.
All right, hey, gentlemen. Tom. Good evening.
A real psychic. Hey. Like me. Anyway, we have quite a bit to talk about, of course. I watched a lot of boxing this weekend, believe it or not. It's not going to be all MMA this week for me, anyway. I watched Friday Night Fights. I tuned in just in time to see the short-lived main event there with Rancez Barthelemy. I don't have his opponent's name.
Nice body shot, though.
Yeah, it was... very short fight, hit him with a beautiful shot to the kidney, I guess, or the rib, and I forget the guy's name, he was so short. He went right down.
It was a long name. I think his name was longer than the fight, but just goes to show it takes more than toughness in there. I mean, obviously the guy came from a pretty tough background, but good body shot didn't matter.
And his next opponent, actually, ironically enough, he's trying to call out Aguinas Mendez, who is actually scheduled to fight his Barthelemy's last opponent, Arash Usmani, who I thought won the fight against Barthelemy, and I'm a big Barthelemy fan since I've seen him in action a few times. So now Barthelemy's trying to get him next because he's got the title and he wants and thinks that's the matchup for him. So, obviously, with a common opponent, they'll have both faced by the time that fight's done. He'll have a better understanding of what he can expect out of that fight. But he's looking to make some steps up. I thought he stepped up a little too early against the guy who was undefeated, like Usmani was, and he ended up getting the kiss decision there. So, I guess a little bit of a luck doesn't hurt in these situations, but we had another fight this weekend, Saturday, that was very controversial. I know that Paulie Malignaggi is no stranger to that, but this time he was at home. Brooklyn is where he grew up, and he's at the Barclays Center there. And the fight was promoted by Golden Boy, so Golden Boy and Floyd Mayweather are real good friends, and Floyd Mayweather and Adrian Broner are real good friends, and actually they're both managed by the same guy, Al Haymon. So, of course, Paulie Malignaggi cried foul and made it sound like he was skipping out of boxing after the fight. Did you get to watch any of that, Tony or Tom?
I did not get to watch it. I was out Saturday night, and it was a fight I really didn't have a whole lot of interest in, because I really have a hard time watching Adrian Broner, and knowing with Malignaggi's style that Malignaggi could potentially outbox him, which some of the people said he was successful in doing, especially over the first half of the fight. I knew Malignaggi, with his lack of punching power, was not a guy that was going to physically put some hurt on him rather than doing it better.
I actually thought Malignaggi won, either or not. I'm not a big fan of his usually, but the way he outworked him with Broner, especially with the body shots early on in the fight, I thought that Broner was just waiting for that knockout punch that never came. And I just thought that. Right. And Broner just pretty much, you know, was throwing one punch at a time and didn't really seem to hurt Malignaggi at all throughout the fight. The only thing I could see is, as far as, you know, Broner getting points was because he did throw the harder shots and landed the harder shots to the head, but Malignaggi was landing a ton of shots to the body, but didn't seem to get caught up in the scoring at all, and didn't give him credit for it. And then Mike Broner complained after the fight. Malignaggi didn't kind of use the whole ring and run around a lot. But that's his style, and that's what wins in fights. That's why he's only got 7 knockouts or something like that. So he's not a knockout artist, but you can't really fault him for that. Supposed to be boxing, you know. Boxing is supposed to be skill and discipline and strategy. So the big thing
was this a majority decision or a split decision?
It was a split decision.
One judge had it for Malignaggi, 115-113. Another judge had it for Broner, 115-113, which is 7 rounds to 5. Then another judge was completely off base. I had it 117-111 for Broner. That's 9 rounds
of 3, and yeah, and I could understand, and even Malignaggi said he could understand if it was close all around. But to give 9 rounds to Broner, I don't see what that guy was watching. And usually there's 2 situations in a fight like that makes you think that the close fight would go to the other guy. And it's a hometown situation for Malignaggi, number one. Not that I approve of hometown cooking, but then you also have the situation of he's the title holder. So you really have to take it from the title holder, this expression you hear a lot in boxing. And neither case seemed to apply to the standard of boxing that we're used to in this fight. So it was kind of puzzling, but then again, like I said, it's a Golden Boy promoted fight. Golden Boy and Floyd Mayweather and Al Haymon and Broner are all pretty tight with each other. So if it was a situation of undue influence, it makes sense. But like a lot of other fights in boxing, when you get those situations, it's really hard to prove that there's fire where there's smoke. So I don't know. You know the facts there. They line up with that kind of philosophy. But as we've always said, boxing is such a subjective sport, and it's opinionated decisions. And, you know, if a fight's not fixed, the guy can just say, well, you know, hey, that was my opinion. I call it so. But Broner didn't look like the fighter that was described in the lead into this fight. And he made a lot of claims that he was going to knock Malik Naji out. And the bottom line is he did not look impressive. Whether you agree that he won or not, he looked like crap compared to what he was hyped up as. So that's just my 2 cents on that. And we had another guy recently going over to a little on the pages. Another guy came out and has criticized the UFC's fighter pay. And it's not a guy who was recently separated from the organization. In fact, he was actually just added to the organization. A very rare occurrence. Usually it's guys that don't have any repercussions to fear. This time, Tim Kennedy made a pretty damaging comment about fighter pay. He says on Grapple Talk, which I'm not familiar with, but this must be another radio show like ours for MMA. He said, Tim Kennedy said, it's pathetic that so many fighters have to have other jobs. I'm one of the 3% of the guys in the entire sport, and it would be slim pickings to survive off what I make in fighting. It's a good thing I have another job because the UFC doesn't pay very well. Anybody who accepts fighters being overpaid as a reality of the sport is sad and pathetic. I hope this isn't the reality of the sport. If it is, I should probably go do something else, like empty trash cans. I'd make more money than I do now. The article referencing this actually says that as a sanitation worker in New York City, you can make over $100,000. And that's, of course, assuming you don't accept gratuities. And I get that joke because I read earlier in the week that a couple guys in New York City, some trash workers there, were fined thousands of dollars for taking a $10 tip in the sport. So you're not supposed to take tips, I guess, when you're a trash guy. But Kennedy is actually in the U.S. Army, so, you know, he does have a very significant job to fall back on. It's interesting that he's mentioned this. Another guy that's not in the UFC but pretty famous, Mike Tyson, has mentioned in the past that the MMA fighters are underpaid. And there have been some cries about forming a fighters union, but... that's another story. Dana White has come out and talked about that a little bit this week as well. He doesn't think it's going to happen because the fighters would have to get behind it. And, of course, another situation where the UFC's contracts are in focus is a story we talked about a little while back where Anderson Silva wanted to fight Roy Jones Jr. And... there's a big fight coming up July 6th, next Saturday, between Silva and Chris Weidman, where a lot of people are picking Weidman to beat Silva. I'm not so sure. I don't think I've seen enough of Weidman to really make a prediction on that one. But obviously, it seems Silva's really looking past it. So Anderson Silva says he sees nothing special about his fight against Weidman. Fight's a fight, he says, and this is another fight. But anyway, he's looking past him right to Roy Jones Jr. But anyway, he says, everything's a possibility, but it's really going to come down to my willpower and my desire to still be fighting. I have a lot of other things I want to do, a lot of other desires. One of those is fighting Roy Jones. We're just going to see how things work out in the next few fights and how I feel. Many have wondered why Silva would want to fight Jones, a boxer whose best days are well behind him. Says, I feel that this boxing style is one that I would like to test myself against, or that his boxing style. I've always been a fan of his, and I've always wanted to test myself against Roy Jones. If he loses to Weidman on July 6th, Silva feels that he has already done everything he can do in the sport of MMA. Whatever I should have done, should have already done in the sport, I've already done. Win or lose, I've already done everything there is to do, and now it's just a matter of doing what I love to do. But as we know from the past UFC contract situations, they usually don't let other fighters work in other promotions. The only exception being when the Strikeforce fighters came over to the UFC and still had their open contracts in place where they were cross promote and work with different companies. But I don't know if they'll make a special exception for this one. I know that Dana White has kind of inserted himself in the boxing versus MMA debate in the past, and Floyd Mayweather has called him out a few times and made some comments on that on those lines, but this is a major champion in the sport to ask him to go over and fight a boxer. So I doubt it's going to be approved, but we'll see. I could be wrong. Talking of cross promotions, of course, we detailed the story of Quentin Jackson, Rampage, and he's going to be back in the movie. That's the story this week. He's actually written his own movie. And when he signed a deal with Viacom to fight for Bellator and wrestle for TNA Impact, he also made some deals to work on some movie ideas and a reality show. But Paramount Pictures, which is owned by Viacom, is going to be putting this movie out. Jackson created his own part and his own script. And he recently went on Beatdown Radio, I'm sure, to talk about the movie, which will start shooting pretty soon. And he's actually still dealing with, I think, a knee injury. I don't know whether he had surgery on it or not, but he's still recovering from that. So I guess doing the movie won't bother him with that situation. So it's going to keep him busy while he's recovering. But he said, the first movie I'm doing is one I wrote. I've seen a few MMA movies out there, and I just wasn't happy with the way they portrayed MMA, period, and the fighters. They just didn't hit the true essence of what it takes to be an MMA fighter. Me being an MMA fighter, I've been in it for 12, 13 years. I decided to make a movie about something that goes on with me and just some other parts of MMA that people don't really talk about. I made a movie about the brotherhood and stuff in MMA, and the inside and how the promoters are. I think the script is really good. I let a couple people read it, and they were like, wow. A lot of people think it could be like a type of MMA movie that people could really attach themselves to and make a couple of sequels from. I just want you guys to know I'm sitting down with a professional writer, somebody that can help me write it and bring it to life a little bit more because I'm not a writer. Well, that's good news. I was going to say, not to knock his intelligence level, but I don't see Rampage as much of a writer myself, and I don't think he was much of an actor according to his performance on the A-Team either. So. Anyway, we'll see how that goes. Maybe it could be the new MMA Rocky series.
I really think his talents would be better served as a stand-up comedian. I think that he may have some talent there, but I would agree with you on the writing. And I didn't see him in the movie, so I can't comment on that.
Wow, you're one of the lucky ones.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. Ronda Rousey's back in the news again with Miesha Tate. Not only did Miesha Tate get the rivalry going again by going on the Ultimate Fighter show that's currently taping out there in Las Vegas, but she's also going to be the next female MMA fighter to go nude for ESPN, the magazine's body issue that was released this last week. And coincidentally enough, as this news came out, just before this news came out, actually, Dana White told reporters last week that the relationship between Rousey and Tate has devolved into some true nastiness. And he says, it's going exactly the way you'd expect it to be going. Bad. I'm dead serious. Miesha and Ronda hate each other. It's literally crazy drama every day. It's irritating. I don't even know if some of this stuff will make TV. It's that bad. Those two do not like each other, and their camps do not like each other. And it's just pure expletive mayhem every day. And for the magazine, anyway, Tate will be in her birthday suit alongside 20 other prominent athletes, including San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick and professional volleyball player Kerry Walsh Jennings. And Rousey was actually one of the most heavily advertised athletes for the fourth body issue, which hit stores a year ago. And ESPN elected to feature her as one of the four cover athletes. It's not sure, nobody sure if Tate would be on the cover though. And actually, Dana White has compared the Rowdy versus Cupcake rivalry there as almost as bad as Tito Ortiz versus Ken Shamrock.
Oh!
So, that just goes to show you how bad it is. And, of course, we have no shortage of athletes getting in deep trouble in the media this week. One of my New England Patriots is wrapped up in a big murder case that I've been writing a little bit about and following up here. But mixed martial arts is not immune, of course, either to this type of thing. We talked, I think, last week about a guy that wrapped up in some heroin dealings. Now we've got Tim Kerdor, who was on The Ultimate Fighter and was in the UFC for a little while. He turned himself in Monday to be booked in Louisiana on two misdemeanor charges. And according to Lafayette Parish booking records, he was arrested and booked on one count of misdemeanor marijuana possession and carrying a concealed weapon. And Fedor was 12-4 in MMA with a 3-2 UFC record. And he was on the seventh season of Tough, up to the semifinals as an underdog before losing to Jesse Taylor. And Taylor was later disqualified for disciplinary reasons. If I recall, I think he kicked out the window of a limo when they went out in the town. And he got a little drunk and sloppy. So ended up making his career elsewhere. But Cordero was injury prone throughout his UFC tenure and was forced out of multiple bouts as a result. His final professional match came in June 2011 when he lost via TKO to Ed Herman at the Ultimate Fighter 13 finale. And he earned a Fight of the Night bonus for a losing effort against Nate Quarry at UFC Fight Night 19 in 2009. And he's got UFC wins over Cale Yarborough, Nate Loughlin, and Nick Gatone. But now he's going to be fighting inmates if he has to do some jail time here. And getting back to criticism of Dana White and the fighter pay issue. Another issue there with Dana White surfaced this week when Randy Couture had a couple issues. Number one, he complained about not being able to corner his son. And how much BS that is. They barred him from being anywhere near the cage when his son fights. But he also, Randy Couture also came out in Sports Illustrated in an interview with them related to this Fightmaster series and what he's doing now. And he says the Fertittas are using, quote, using Dana White. And he says, that's how Dana operates. That's the sword he wields. That's how the Fertittas use him. They know he's going to react. They know he's going to say the things he's going to say. He goes out of his way to be hurtful, to be insulting, to drop F-bombs, and to try to push buttons. That's how he operates. He's very predictable in that regard. At the press conference for Fight Master, I thanked him for creating such a media storm for the brand new show. And I don't operate that way. It's not personal for me. It's about making the best business decisions I can for my brand and for the sport of mixed martial arts. So, it is what it is there. Let's see what else we got. For some reason, I have mostly mixed martial arts stories here today. But getting back to the Malik Nagy situation, I'd just like to read some of his quotes from after the fight to add to that. He said, I thought it was an entertaining fight and the fans got their money's worth, but it's a lot of bullshit. there's politics and you get bullshit like this. It's part of the game and somebody should do something about it. I don't have to fight again. I make good money in boxing and I work with Showtime. I'm not saying it was fixed, but it was always, it's always the more connected fighter who gets the decision. He was sharp in spots, but he wasn't busy and didn't land. They looked pretty. When he did work, he was good, but I had the better pace. And like I said, before the showdown, Broner had promised to knock out Malignaggi and win his title in the same way he claimed to have taken old Flame to the opponents. But he was pushed beyond 10 rounds for the first time and had to work for his 27th victory of his career.
Yeah, a couple of things that just observations that I had. Like I said, I didn't watch it live. I did see the transcripts of Malignaggi's post-fight tirade. And you know what? I know a friend of mine. He's a fellow boxing writer, and I know him personally from South Philly. And he was saying that, like, Paulie this and Paulie that, and Paulie could be sued for things he said against Al Haymon, saying basically that Haymon influenced the judges because he represents Broner. And then he turned around and said, well, do you think Haman's really going to waste his time on that? I mean, this guy's raking in a hell of a lot of money advising some big-name fighters. But at the same time, I know what I'm talking about. I know I've said things to people, and then I've said things to the press that, you know, definitely, were, taken in a very negative context. So, I mean, it's a fighter being angry. You know, boxing is a very competitive sport. You know, you get your adrenaline rush when you're in there. And when you work so hard and you think you've earned something and they steal it from you, or at least in your eyes they steal it from you.
What happened? Did you lose, Tony? Last time. You're still there, right, Colin?
I'm still here.
I don't know. You hung up on me. We're still here.
Okay. No, I was just saying, you know, I can understand why he was peeved a little bit. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be a situation where they try to sue him or anything like that. My dad was like, I wonder if that's going to affect his status with Showtime, you know? Because now he's come up and he was, you know, very passionate and, you know, very, angry. And now how is that going to affect his contract to be a broadcaster? And the other thing my dad said made a good point. It's like now if he does continue to be a broadcaster, he has his next fight, he can't dwell on this fight. You know, you got to, you know, put that in the back of your mind. You're a broadcaster now. You're not, you know, talking about yourself. Like, hey, Joe Schmo's fighting this guy. So this is like when I fought Adrian Broner and they ripped me off, and it's not, you got to get away from that. I'd like to see Broner go through with his promise to let the fans pick his next opponent, because you got some really good options out there. If he's fighting at 147 now, he skipped right over 140 conveniently, because I think that he is, I don't think he wants any of Matisse.
Right.
I really don't think he does.
His name did surface on Twitter in the discussions about who was next.
Well, sure. I mean, Matisse has been running through guys. And, I mean, I'm not saying he would do that to Broner, but he would definitely get there. If Paulie was able to hit Broner, now, Paulie's quick-fisted. He's a good boxer. He throws punches and bunches, but he has no power. You see, he's not as quick-fisted guy. He's not a flashy guy. But he's a guy hits you with a glancing punch and hurts you. I'd like to see what he can do again. That would be a very good boxer versus puncher matchup. And I would like to see it.
Some of the names that have been mentioned, Marcos Maidana, who beat Josecito Lopez on the same card there. Then we had Robert Guerrero mentioned, actually. Gennady Golovkin. Let's see who else. And also...
You, I mean, Golovkin played this weekend, and he's at 160. And I know Bruno, and this is one that kind of made me laugh a little bit, that how he's buddy-buddy with Floyd Mayweather now, and it's like, oh, no, we would never fight each other because we're friends.
Yeah.
I don't know what Floyd's opinion is on that, but Floyd's name is Floyd Money Mayweather for a reason, and if they said, oh, shit, this is the biggest fight out there, Floyd, and we're going to pay you $50 million for it, he'd be like, friend who? You can't get to your ass in the ring, you know? But it reminds me, like, in school, when, like, the one kid, he's afraid to the bully, and he doesn't want the bully to beat him up, so what's he doing? He becomes his friend, his sidekick. Like, kind of in the Christmas story, when there's, like, that the bully that's beating all the kids up, and he has that little toady with him, and then he just picks on the guys because he's with the bully. And he's like, yeah, we're pals, aren't we? You know, that's what it reminds me of. Yeah, we'll never fight each other because we're best buds, aren't we? And I could see Floyd be like, you know what, the hell with that. I'm making the money. My name's Floyd Money Mayweather for a reason. And I think he would slap the shit out of Broner, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break from our news commentary and connect with Hector Camacho Jr. And we'll actually... about August. August 8th. Hello? Hello, Hector.
Yes.
Hey, this is Ramble Razz and Rich Bergeron from Fight News Unlimited. How's it going?
I'm doing well, Bobby. You ready?
Yep. We also have Tony the Tornado Pentacal on the line and resident psychic Tom Padgett.
Good evening, Hector.
Well, fellas, good to hear from you guys.
All right. So, Hector, tell us what's been going on. How you been?
Everything good, man. Thank God every day. Everything going well. And it's been a long stretch, a tough stretch. My father passed away. I've been going through the motions, but everything's coming to place now. Thank God for keeping me strong, focused, and hungrier than ever, ready to go out there and take what's mine in the boxing business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the first thing that you know, I said when we got on the air tonight is, I wanted to pass on the condolences, you know, for the loss of your father. I remember him, you know, growing up for so many years watching him, and I feel for that. You know, really sorry about how everything ended up.
Mhm. I mean, we lost a good man, a good fighter, a good entertainer. A great pioneer of boxing. I mean, he did bring style and fashion to boxing as far as being a pro fighter. And, you know, people like that, it's hard to, you know, forget about. But through him, I gained the motivation. I also formed the foundation, Guns Down, Gloves Up, to help the youth, to stop the violence that's going on in this world. And through him, his legacy will keep going on through me.
And now, Hector, I know we haven't heard much about it, but... Do you know if there's been any arrests or anybody brought to justice for this?
You know what? As of now as we speak, there were two guys that was arrested, but I haven't been in the case as much as I've been, you know, focusing on myself, on boxing. I don't want to get caught up emotionally with what's going on. So I try to stay away from it, not touch base too much on the death of my father, who did it, who did it, who did not. I believe in the judge. I believe in God. And... justice will be served soon, so I try to stay away from it.
All right. And what can you tell us about your next opponent there? You're fighting in August, Lee Marchand.
August 8th, I want to thank Pretty Girl Promotions. She's a female promoter, and by the way, doing a great job. Been in boxing for a long time. She's a woman, a female fighter, and a female promoter who been doing everything she says. She promoted the fight well, and she'll be training well up to now. And think come on, she'll be ready. We've been training, focused, hungry. We've been busting our chops in the gym, having a new team around me. And we're ready to go out there overseas and put on a show at the boxing world, know that, you know, I'm still here. And count on me.
All right. And you've obviously had a lot of fights. There's not too many guys out there who have more than 50 fights. You've already got more than 50 wins. So what's it like to keep so busy over the course of your career?
It's good to come back and, you know, stay busy. But now, so I know my tunnel, my after that tunnel, you know, coming to the club, my career coming to an end soon. The next 2-3 years, so I want to give the best I could the next 2-3 years, and I promise what I can accomplish, something I didn't do back in the early years, which I thought of my career, I thought of how to move a team that never takes the next level. I guess it's part of me just being lackluster, being, you know, being not getting 100% in training, not doing what I'm supposed to do, you know, relying on my talent, not training as hard, and now it's through the tunnel. Closing up on me, I'm ready to give 100%. It's hard, it's tough for a guy with my name, my ability, my talent to either sport a boxing or nothing. I want to make sure I'm going over the bank. And I'm every day, I'm just enjoying the moment. I'm enjoying the training. Something I've been for a long time, enjoying myself in the gym, enjoying the road works, enjoying giving the youth advice. And I'm staying busy, hands on, every day I'm doing boxing right now. Something I haven't done in a long time. Like, for the first time, I fell in love with the sport again.
Early in your career, it was on the David Reed Kevin Kelly undercard back in July of 1999. I took two of my at the time co-workers. There were two supervisors, had neither ever attended a pro fight, so I took them down to a world title fight. I think this was your 23rd professional fight against a guy named Mike Cooley. And you stopped him in two rounds. I remember you beat him up pretty good. And he saw him in the lobby on the way out, and he was busted up pretty bad. And I remember my one friend saying, Mike Cooley, he ain't the hammer, he's the hammered.
You know what's crazy? I keep in touch with Mike Cooley on Facebook, and I'm always getting on top of him every time. And those are the good news in boxing. I remember that fight in Atlantic City. I remember it was yesterday. But that's the kind of performance we're looking at now. I have a good team behind me. You know, I got a great PR guy, Chris Seller. A great sponsor on the marquee, Team Kamasha. We're ready to come out before we close the door in boxing and put our name on top one more time and keep my father's legacy alive. Keep the name Kamasha out there.
Mm-hmm. And who would you say is the toughest guy you ever fought?
I don't want to say myself, man. I'm my own opponent at times. And most fighters, the kind of times that I have to say the same thing. When you get to 100%, you can be beaten any given night. I mean, boxing. Every fighter has two hands. I mean, it's you really got to be prepared 100%. That's why I take my hat off to a guy like Floyd Mayweather. It can't be about the money. I mean, this guy has been fighting for years and performing at the top of his game for years. He's been in the gym for years. So when it comes down to it, I'm my worst enemy. I'm my worst opponent. That's the point I ever had myself.
I'm going to ask this question. I don't know if this has ever happened in boxing ever. But taking a look at your record and then also taking a look at some of your opponents, this is the first time I've ever seen it happen. But back in 2009, about 4 years ago, your father fought to a draw with Yuri Boy Campos. And then you fought him in his next fight. Has that ever happened anywhere ever where a fighter has fought a father and a son in back-to-back fights?
You know why? No, I don't think it ever happened. It's the first time. It's the first time. The first time a fighter got beat up by a father and a son. It's real.
All right. And what's your ultimate goal in the sport?
Put my name back on top, you know, go out with the name Kamasha High, get that title that was craved for, that the people, my fans want to see me grab. My critics, Jack can't do it, and I want to leave the game in high, and even mark in boxing.
Right. And what would you say is the one thing, or multiple things, I guess, that you enjoy most about actually fighting? Career.
The adrenaline, the excitement, the rush. When you know you're going there, you're about a minute away. When they knock on the door, say, come on, you have a minute left before you go in the ring. That feeling, that adrenaline, that rush is great. And you're preparing for war, also a great feeling. Like, I'm enjoying it right now. Before, training camp used to be trying to hate training camp. And then it was a little morning jog, but now I'm loving it. I feel good. Like, I'm the first one up at 5:30 in the morning. I'm out the door. I mean, I'm going up again with the feeling of boxing. I'm getting ready for war.
Right. Awesome. That must be a good feeling to have.
It's junior time.
And do you have any favorite fighters that you really watch a lot of? I know you mentioned Floyd Mayweather you have a lot of respect for. Are there any other fighters that you try to watch?
Sugar Ray Leonard. I love the 80 fighters, the Hagler, the Hearns, the Camacho, of course. That was a good time of boxing. Those were the good days. That's a physical fighter. They were classy. You don't have these fighters now, they're going to be rappers. These fighters getting boxing a bad image.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about. You have to be fighters now that are getting boxing a bad image. I mean, it's not good. It's a bad taste. And we lose a lot of views, a lot of following. The followers of the boxing entertained them more. Back when it was in the 80s. It was classier back in the 80s. They were respect for one another.
Yeah. Well,
nowadays, you know, you got fighters going to be rappers. And, you know, it's just a whole different market now. It's an urban crowd. It's something totally different. But I told her, I swear, I mean, you got new people in the boxing game, 50 cents. You got, you know, you're trying to help box one way or another. I know it's going to help us out. It's going to derail boxing, but hey.
Yeah, I was just going to say, 50 cents a rapper who wants to be a boxer, the other way around.
You got it all. You get it all in boxing. You have it all in boxing. I'm glad that the Horn definitely putting good shows on Showtime. Keep it finding live. Keeping boxing alive. I put on good quality matchups on Showtime every month. I go fight it. Be a big good fight thing scheduled. I keep boxing alive. HBO doing the European fighters. I mean, you know, we test different markets. The fighters are not what they was before.
Right. Now, there's a lot of news lately, of course, after we were just talking about Paulo Malignaggi's fight against Adrian Broner. Have you been a victim of hometown cooking or bad decisions or controversy in any of your fights? And what's that like to deal with, if you have?
I thank God I haven't been in that yet. I have not had a bad hometown vibe, nothing yet. I can't speak into it. But man, you understand Paulie's way, but at the same time, the fight before that, Paulie also got a gift when he fought the panel guy. Fight before last, he had a gift. I thought he lost the fight, he gave it to him. And this way, it can go either way. I mean, this is boxing.
Right.
Which they have to clean up now, but it's boxing. It's boxing. Not a bad judge, not a bad scoring. I mean, every other day, you see two scores on TV, on HBO or Showtime, that was on TV now. I mean, everything's changing. There's more who got political power now in the sport, who sells. I mean, that's the boxing we know.
And do you see any way that that could be fixed at this stage, or do you think it's too far gone?
I mean, it's tough to say. It's tough to say, man. I mean, you have to hold like Oscar with a fighter being a promoter not trying to change the game. George Foreman trying some fights. We can only hope they clean up, you know, for a future down the line, for other fighters can have, a future fighters can have a chance. I mean, you see what MMA happened. MMA fought off well and just, you know, it dropped it off on them on cage and dropped it off a little bit. So boxing is still there at the top. But we have to clean it up. I mean, we have better role models in boxing. So you can't go on there. You're like a soap popper. You go on there, LeBron will fight. They fight over a girl on TV. The media is making a big thing out of it. Jessica this, Jessica that. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, speaking of role models, who helped you get up in the game? Obviously, your father was there for you and certain points, but is there anybody else in your life that helped you out along the way?
Through God. God been with me from day one. My parents always been on top of me. I seen a lot in the street. I grew up in the hood. You know, people say Camacho Jr. People must have thought I grew up in the spot. So a spoon. No, I grew up in the hood. I seen a lot. I've been through a lot, and definitely the death of my father opened my eyes up and become a better person. They want to help out more, help the youth out more, and stop the violence. And I'm getting my hands in. I'm talking to the youth. I'm in the streets every day, and I'm at the gym. I'm training different boxing gyms here in Puerto Rico, in different neighborhoods, bad neighborhoods. Talking to the kids, setting an example. I'm paying it. You know, even in New York, that's long ago. I was in New York City, and I was taking kids to help females with their carriage, baby carriages. They go out to help them with their carriage. I give $10. You know, I try to help as much as I can and help the youth, man. So, I mean, if more fathers get out there like that and more people in the world and try to help out and set an example and be a role model, it'd be a better world, especially for boxers. And we got Floyd Mayweather coming up the sport a little bit, you know, with the guests that just casting and his way to come out of jail, being different now. He's playing something different. Then we need role models in boxing to help the sport out. Or not, we're going to lose it.
He's at least a lot more respectable to his father now that he's out of jail. So,
yes.
He's on a lot better with Floyd Senior.
The time of setback is a blessing.
Right. Now, how about your favorite punch? Do you have a favorite punch that you use more than any other, or you just like to throw it?
You know what? I find a southpaw stance. I'm naturally righty. I bang my left. I've been falling in love with body punches. The last past 3 years I've been in the gym to work on body punches. I've been falling in love with the body shots, man. I don't have a favorite punch. People say my left hand, because I'm much more life with my left hand. I'm left-handed. But my body punches have definitely paying it to me. Working in the gym over time on body shots and body shots, and it's finally coming together.
So you say you're naturally right-handed? So did you start out?
I'm naturally right-handed. You know, when I play baseball, I'm just a bad southpaw. I'm a different. When I lay up basketball, I'm an athlete too. I play all sports. But, you know, when I play basketball, I shoot my left hand. Baseball, I pitch on my hand. I'm a dexterous, but.
Right. So when you started boxing, were you trying to fight right-handed, or did you just immediately go to
When I started boxing, all I see is my father, and he's always playing in the southpaw position. And he was a right-handed natural fighter. He's right-handed naturally. But he was boxing a southpaw stand. So that's the first thing I see, the first thing I recognize. So I thought over the southpaw.
All right. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I've tried switching to southpaw. I'm naturally right-handed and done a little amateur boxing. But I don't know if I could permanently switch for one fight like in the one Rocky movie there.
You know what? It's all about the time you put into everything. I learned that as time went on. It was the craft, the time you put in the craft. I mean, you're in the gym, practicing, switching on and off, and you become natural at that time, you know?
Right. And now you're getting ready for a big fight. What would you say is the most important thing in your training routine that you do to get up for a fight?
Stay hungry, stay positive. Stay positive and hungry. And stay motivated, you know. In the morning, I talk to myself now in the gym. I hit the bag, and I curse myself out sometimes. Come on, goddamn, put another round. Push it out. You know, I try to fire myself up now. Keep myself motivated. Keep myself in a good spirit, in a good mood. That's the main thing. I got a tough Irish kicker in front of me. And when you fight an Irish boy, like fighting a Hispanic, a Mexican, a Puerto Rican, they, you know, hot-blooded. So I was expecting a tough fight. I prepared for a tough fight. I went to the gym every day. I'm jogging every day. Just working along. And after this fight, I'm a bigger fight. I'm taking it step by step. Taking each fight step by step, I'm focused on the big prize. I'm working towards that. I'm assuming I'm in 6 months in peak condition if I keep doing what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on speed. I mean, that's my best. That's my talent. That's my natural. I'm working on speed. I sort of let go of the art of boxing. I fell in love with my power, knocking people out. It came easy. I left boxing, I left moving, and now learning that again, going back to my basics. There are guys in the gym, former world champion, Carlos Santos, I mean, Puerto Rican world champion, name is Carlos Santos, having the gym with me at times. People are pushing me. You know, your father's training hard. You got to train hard. And that's during the year, I bust your chops. Your father's training 2 hours. I got people constantly in my ear telling me, come on. I mean, it's helping me out, man. Training's going well.
Mm-hmm. Anyway,
my father went away. Puerto Rico's had embraced me now, you know. Sort of, you know, well, the love that my father gave it to me, so that's another motivation.
Right. Well, that's great. It's pretty incredible. I mean, you know, to have that that change in heart, too, makes you kind of wonder if your father is inside you in some way, you know. Pushing you on. You must feel like that.
I believe so. You know, sometimes I be lazy when I don't get up in the morning. My alarm is at 4:15. I do my prayers at 4:15. I get up in the morning. I thank God. You know, Allahu Akbar. Thank you for another day. And you know, I do what I do. And the first thing comes to my mind, Father, tell me get your fat ass up and go running. But then you know, He stays with me in my mind all the time. You know.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else got any questions?
Yeah, Hector, being the son of a world champion, I could imagine would have some advantages for you, but I could also imagine it had some disadvantages also, maybe like putting a lot of expectations on you and a lot of pressure on you. Did you feel some extra pressure when you started fighting?
You know what? When I first turned pro, I knew people would compare me. They were doing the amateur. They were doing it when I was young, in the boxing gym. Oh, you're like your father. And when I went to amateur, I told me the same thing. When your father made it to the big trials, I made it to the big trials. When I turned pro, you become better than your father, but you're like your father. So that's constantly, all week of my whole career, people always tell me the same thing, comparing me. So I learned to live with it. To a point, after my first loss, I feel like I put off my shoulder. They stopped comparing me. And then I feel comfortable now. But yeah, man, it was stressful. Even to this day, man, people, you know, old woman, you're like your father, you can look like your father. You know, this is always, you want like your father, you talk like your father. And, you know, that's something I got used to doing, man. But it has its pros and it has its cons. The pros are you got open names,
exactly.
To open doors.
Exactly.
But the
con, I think
is
a lot of
people live up to that shadow and that shadow's tough.
Right, right. Because I think a lot of people will look at you and say, well, this guy had a few doors open for him. But when it comes down to it, you're still the guy making that walk to the ring. You're still the guy that has
you're
to go in there and perform. I don't care what your name is, regardless. And I know
yes.
that there could be some downsides,
yes.
too.
And what's up, people? People like Marshall Camacho only come on every 50 years. You don't see great fathers that often. Those kind of fighters go on every 50 years. You go in there and then Macho Camacho, Floyd Mayweather. Those type of fighters don't come around too often. Sometimes it's unfair. It's unfair to compare them. I mean, how could you compare yourself to? But then again, that's part of the world we live in. And then, you know, I've been swamped with that since the beginning of my career. So I tend to block it out, but it's tough. It's frustrating at times.
Oh, sure. But I think all you can do is perform and do the best you can with what you're doing, and I think you've done
exactly.
it. I think you've done a great job. I really congratulate you on the progress and the career you've had, and best of luck going forward.
Thank you. The only Iceman the King against the world championship, he's the sport of boxing in history. Like father, like son. He won a world champion like his father. I mean, that's the only thing left for me to do now.
Yeah, what would you say is the biggest difference between your style and your father's?
I would say that I'm heavier. I'm a better puncher. Same style. I kind of like to bang out a little bit.
Yeah.
But you see the same thing, man. When you see Camacho in his shape, you see Camacho in his shape and on his weight, you see a reflection of the senior. Same speed, same kind of boxing style.
Yeah. Tony, you got something?
That's a bit of a difference in me. I'm better looking.
Tony, you got something there?
No, I said I had most of my questions down in the beginning. Then I limited the time to let Tom talk.
Oh. All right, Hector. What would you say was your best moment so far in the sport?
I have a couple of them. Best moments was being seen calling my father 3 times. That's rare. You could do that. A person who idolized, a person who I seen growing up wanted to be like, and I pulled the same show from 3 times. And my highlight was that when I was mean, you know, HBO, you put him on the undercard. So that's my father's moment. So my father put him on the undercard. But, I mean, I'm still living it. And the problem I have now, winning my first, of course, get over that hump. I won a couple championships, 9 championships. But the best is still yet to come. I still have fire left in me. I'm going to give it one more last try, one more last hurrah. Only for myself, for my father on top of there.
Yeah, that's interesting. You mentioned you said you fought on the same card as your father. 3 times?
Nerve-wracking.
we were just talking about that because a few weeks ago they claimed in an article from Australia that Francois Botha and his son fighting on the same card was the first time that ever happened. And I knew it had to be another case of that happening. Now you're telling me it happened three times in your
time. Three times. And the funny one was this one. We were on the same show, I believe, 2007 in Arizona. So I was having a problem with weight. Nothing, you know, I was overweight and actually underweight. So I had an opponent, and I was about 2 or 7 pounds overweight. So my father comes in the day before the fight, and he tells me, you know, how much you weigh? I said, probably got like 8 pounds to lose. You know what, man? Let me take your opponent, take my opponent. And we switched the opponent the day before the fight. And then the weigh-in, I couldn't make weight. I took his opponent. If his opponent weighed at 160, I was weighing 162. And my opponent, my father, was 154. He was 152. So we actually switched the opponent the day of the weigh-in, which that was ironic, man. It was a blessing because my opponent was tougher than his.
Man, that is a crazy story. So what was the result? The final result of that one?
Well, I won my knockout, and he won by decision. He won for him that night.
Cool.
It was a good night for boxing.
Awesome. All right, Tom.
I want to give a thanks to the guys for having me on, and special thanks to my PR guy, Chris Sella, King Camacho, my wife, who's been cooking healthy for me. She's been really busting my chop, my wife. I'm hungry at nighttime. She didn't want to cook. When at nighttime, I want to sleep with her. She won't let me sleep with her, so I get mad. I'm forced to run twice to really stress. So, I mean, everything's going well, man. August 8th, in Jesus' time.
Awesome. Well, tell us a little bit about this Find a Dream that you're involved in, too. We haven't mentioned that yet.
Yeah, Find a Dream. I occasionally do things with them. The foundation is making dreams, giving kids an opportunity. They don't have opportunity. It's sort of what I'm doing now. My own foundation is called Guns Down, Gloves Up. It's, you know, I'm focusing on helping kids here in the gym, opening boxing gyms up, throwing in the gloves, doing little tournaments, boxing tournament, baseball, basketball tournament. Just keep the kids off the streets, man. Let them know that there's more out there just being in the streets. If you use that same mind frame as you do hustling in the street, you can use it in the corporate world. So we're trying to help the violence, trying to take the kids in a positive direction. And I said they found the dream the same thing. They didn't take the opportunity. They don't have an opportunity. So, you know, it all goes in the same hat.
Right. Awesome. Well, is there any final thoughts you have or anybody else you want to give a shout-out to before we go?
I'm good to go, man. I thank God to my mother and people who listen to Salaam Alaikum to the rest. God bless the rest. And I got a special friend they call Marky who's listening. Mm-hmm. Keep going, buddy. Thank you, fellas.
Well, it's great talking to you, and I know you probably won't need it, but we wish you the best of luck on August 8th, and we'll be watching. We'll be keeping in touch.
Thank you. Always need it. Thank you, brother.
All right. Good luck, Hector.
Good night. Oops. How many minutes? All right, so you have Hector Camacho Jr. It's kind of funny, I thought, when I asked him what the biggest difference between him and his father, he said he was better looking. That's a little of the old senior coming through in the junior. I haven't really watched a lot of his fights, but I'm pretty sure he's probably not as flamboyant as his father was, and the way he dressed and everything, with the leopard prints and all that stuff. But
he was more conservative with his father. Not too many people could be more flamboyant than his father, but he's a lot more conservative, and style-wise, too, he's a lot more of a conservative, more traditional type of fighter. When he gets a southpaw, but he was more like more technique-based, where his father was more, more speed and more, benefiting from just being so unorthodox.
Right. Well, definitely looking forward to seeing if he can reach that goal or get another world title. Sounds like he's in a whole new mindset. He's coming off a couple knockout victories, too, looking at his record. TKO in the fifth in his last fight, and then before that, a knockout in the fourth. Granted, these guys weren't world beaters that he fought, but it was after almost a year off when we got back to it in April of this year. So, you know, we're looking, definitely looking forward to seeing how he does this August.
I was going to ask you what our status is going to be for next week, so next Thursday, before, and God knows where I'll be.
Do we need to do a special broadcast, recorded version? We could do that sometime before the fact, if we can set it up. I know I'm not going to be busy, so I can do it solo if I have to, just do something quick.
Well, how much fun is that?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I've done this solo twice. The one time a couple of years ago, when you had a situation where you had to leave, you signed me on, and then I just went for like an hour-ish. And guests could still call in. We had two guests that night. And the one I had to set the interview up was following this online, and that's when we had a chat room, and the guy was like going, you want my guy to call in early? I'm like, yes, have them call in right now, immediately. Don't even wait another 5 minutes. It was to the point where I exhausted my topics, and I was like, oh, shit, what am I going to do now? So I held my phone up to the computer, and I played a song, like, oh, let's have a brief musical interlude here. And I played a song, and I was like, okay, I'm back. So I felt like a radio DJ there. And then this guy was able to get his guests on. Just a few months ago, when I did the solo show, I had Tom on the email sending me information, sending me stories to read and questions to ask. And that was definitely another unique show.
Yeah, we'll think of something. But yeah, it's a good point. It is the fourth. So we'll figure something out, I'm sure. But pick a night, I guess, if you guys can be available before then to at least do maybe an hour or so. And I'll keep that in mind as I look for my story to talk about. I still haven't finished talking about that one card on Showtime. I guess it was Showtime, yeah. Seth Mitchell versus Jonathan Banks happened on that card in a rematch. And it wasn't very entertaining from what I saw, especially for the big guys.
It was terrible, and Kofi was saying like Banks just completely let him off the hook. He had Mitchell hurt, and he just backtracked. And I know the one gentleman that I talked to that sometimes can get a little controversial with his opinions. He kept coming out and saying, "I think Banks is selling this fight." He goes, "He has Mitchell hurt, and he's backing off." He goes, and like I said, he took it to a level that I wouldn't have gone to, but he like. I think, Banks is, like, pulling off because he wants to be a trainer now. You know, he doesn't want to fight with the Klitschko's because he trains John Vladimir. So it's like, I think they set it up where Mitchell can beat him and get back in the title picture. And I was like, yeah, I ain't going to get that far. I didn't watch the fight, but, you know, just another opinion out there.
Well, Mitchell got his belt back, of course. Got the unanimous decision win. It might have been that impressive, but it was definitely another heavyweight fight there. And also on that card, we had Saki Obika of Australia won his super middleweight fight over Marco Antonio Parabon. And Parabon, that was his first loss. He was 20-0 before that with 13 knockouts. And according to this article, it was a sloppy, crazy fight with plenty of action to keep the restless Brooklyn fans happy. But the hardest blows came from multiple headbutts. I didn't get to watch that one, unfortunately. But it is what it is. And, of course, this weekend we have the big fight is Genevieve Golovkin facing off against... Matthew Macklin. And I know Genevieve is a Cincinnati. I don't know exactly how you pronounce it. I know he's one of the hottest prospects in the sport today, and he looks good at every fight I've seen him in. But we'll see how he does here. It's a guy that's pretty well known overseas. Over in the UK. This is not really a story, but something I just wanted to see if you guys have noticed lately. I just don't understand it, but I keep seeing advertising on TV for the UFC fight on UFC on FX10, I guess it was. That was on June 8th. It's already passed, and they keep advertising it. Have you guys seen those ads?
No, I haven't noticed that.
Well, I know I saw them on Spike on the commercials for the Fight Master show up here. Maybe it's just a regional thing with Comcast up here in New Hampshire. Didn't get the memo that June 8th has already passed. Kind of weird. I can't see that they would spend more money on further advertising for a fight that already happened. Went out there. And I don't know if we mentioned this last week, but Nick Diaz's big event, big first event of War MMA, happened over the weekend. And there were some interesting little tidbits. I know I mentioned that they decided to ask people to pay whatever they thought it was worth, basically, to get the feed. And of course, you know, any beginning promotion is going to have some difficulties in the first event, and one of those difficulties was that the feed crashed for a little while, so they had to have a little bit of a delay. But you know, as regional promotions go, sounds like you know, the people that enjoyed this fight got the best out of it because of these fighters. You know, they're trying to make a big impression, and they're, you know, looking towards getting some kind of contract going, or, you know, getting their names out there. But they scored some points on having their commentators, former WBEC veteran Javier Vasquez and Sherdog TJ DeSantis, were both working on that aspect of the fight. And actually, they had the MMA referee Josh Rosenthal sit in as a guest commentator during one of the opening bouts. And that's pretty rare. You don't usually hear a referee on a broadcast like that. We've had three referees on that show at the same time. Female referees, you know, not too long ago. But as far as out of actual fight, that's pretty rare. And they say that regional shows are notorious for lopsided matchmaking to pad the records of the hometown guys or promotion-friendly fighters, but that really wasn't a problem for War. And they didn't have really any unbalanced undercard fights. But, of course, the good you got to take with the bad. And like I said, the live stream was down for a large part of the first hour. That pushed the starting time back considerably. The issue was resolved, but it was so unfortunate for the opening step into the public world. They had a little bit of sloppiness. Hands-down defense and haymaker offense was the default setting inside the ring, according to this article about it. And so there wasn't a lot of crisp MMA, but it was competitive at least. And fighters, a few fighters put their hands on their knees in exhaustion or turned their backs following heavy shots. And some had some poor showings, but then again, you know, it's the early stages of this, so you've got to kind of forgive that kind of stuff. Another thing that was pretty interesting about this is, other than the breakdown of the footage, the feed, it actually ran pretty smoothly into this report. But as I mentioned, they had a weird setup with the feed. They actually said that we're not going to charge any set amount, but you can donate whatever you want. And I don't know if you guys can guess, but what would you think would be the most common amount that people contributed. Consider Nate Diaz passed. Take a guess. Come on.
Well, I can't say zero. I mean, someone would have to be giving something, but maybe in the $5 range, that's my guess.
Close. Very close. Tony, you get a guess?
I'll say $3.92.
Ooh, I think if this was prices right, Tony would win because it was actually $4.20. $4.20.
Uh-huh.
$0.28 off.
Yeah.
I don't know what you win. But you win. So. And then the person that was supposedly whoever gave the top amount, and I don't have it right here in the story what they won for a prize, but they won some kind of deal with autographed equipment and did dinner with Nate. Nate Diaz, something along those lines. And it doesn't say here what that amount was either, so unfortunately I can't report on that one. Let's see what else we got here. Tom, you had mentioned in an email before the show you wanted to talk a little bit about the Fightmaster show. Again, I missed it this week. My favorite show came back to TNT this week. One of my favorite law shows or lawyer shows there, Franklin and Bash. So I think that's on the same time. I think that's why I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's
still that interesting dynamic about picking the coaches, because some of the questions that the guys ask are just so it's like, wow, why didn't I think of that? I mean, how can you help me, and what did you see and stuff? But apparently, like you mentioned last week about Frank Shamrock's ego, and apparently it really kind of flared up a little bit with Greg Jackson, and I won't say it was hostile, but Frank kept implying that, well, what's the deal with Greg Jackson? What's so special about him? He's never spent a minute in the cage. And for a lot of fighters, that should mean something. And it got me thinking about this whole thing, because we know from the boxing world and MMA to a certain extent, but in boxing especially, some of the greatest trainers really didn't have much of a record, if any, as fighters. And what I'd like to just get your guys' comments on that whole thing is, do you feel that a good trainer has to have a lot of fight experience, or can you be a good trainer with minimal or even no experience? What do you guys think?
If I can interject on that, I sound like a politician. If I can interject on the topic, that's a great question, Tom. What I'll say from there is, probably the trainer I think was the greatest trainer of all time, and it's hard to really talk about some of the old-time trainers, because a lot of this, let's face it, I can't talk as much about Ray Arcel, because he was really before my time. Even when he was training Duran, when Duran was champ back in the late 70s, early 80s, still kind of before my time. Angelo Dundee, before my time, I remember them as trainers. But the one that I do remember, who I still consider maybe the greatest trainer ever, was Eddie Futch. Eddie Futch was amateur lightweight. In Detroit, he was the president of Joe Louis. And unfortunately for a guy like Eddie Futch, he was, they found a heart condition on him. I forget if it was like a heart murmur or a regular heartbeat, which, like, today, they can, they can put you on a medication to, get it regulated. Maybe it was like a hole in his heart. It was something with his heart that forced Eddie Futch, but he had to retire from boxing. Couldn't fight anymore. So at a young age, in his 20s, he started training guys. So now you're taking a player who never fought pro, but basically his knowledge and just learning from the guys around the gym and just being a gym rat, he became probably the greatest trainer ever. And like I said, guys like Lou Duva, Angelo Dundee, Ray Arcel. I can't speak of their boxing experience because it was way before my time. But if you think about it, does anybody remember Angelo Dundee, the boxer? No, not really.
No.
Lou Duva? No. You know, you remember those guys as trainers. So obviously their calling card was made in the field of training. They may have had, you know, some fights. Maybe they were great. Maybe they weren't great. Maybe they weren't even very good. You can take a guy like one of his disciples, Freddie Roach. Freddie Roach was a mediocre fighter. You know, he fought for a world title, but the fact of the matter was he was a mediocre fighter. He was a club fighter, but turned into one hell of a trainer.
Right.
And basically, my feeling on it is guys understand the sport of boxing. Brother Nazim Richardson, who we saw just a few weeks ago in Valley Forge,
right.
I really don't know much about his, you know, boxing background, but he's a hell of a trainer. Trained a lot of his sons. They turned out to be pretty good fighters, one of the Olympics. So that's hard to say. Basically, the trainers that I think are the best are the ones that are able to motivate the fighters. They are able to adapt to the fighters. They can get their fighters respect. Very important. If you have a fighter come up to you saying, well, you don't know what you're talking about because you've never done it, that you know, is not a good situation. Now, you might take some trainers out there that maybe they were amateur fighters. You take a guy like Eddie Futch. He was an amateur fighter. He trained as a lightweight, as a sparring partner for Joe Louis to help Joe Louis deal with speedier fighters. So he was in there. He was in, you know, in the ring with maybe the greatest heavyweight ever as a sparring partner. So, yeah, that's how you learn things. And when a
right.
guy comes back at you and tries to make a comment, well, what do you know? What have you done? What have I done? Maybe I had headgear on. But I still had the Brown Bomber swinging at me,
mm-hmm.
you know? And what
right.
I used to like to do when I would train down in South Philly, you know, I would get there and I would warm up and I would tape my hands up and I would skip my rope and I'd shadow box and then I would, you know, go a few rounds in the ring, hit the heavy bag a few rounds, do my sit-ups and all that. And then I would just sit there and just watch. I would watch the other guys spar. I'd watch the trainers work with the other guys. I would listen to them. Tosh, you get up on the apron with them and do that at Lock Haven. Dr. Cox used to like to have fighters if Chris Cooper wasn't there. He couldn't make the show. Have the fighters help in the corner. So I can't tell you how many times I worked corners at Lock Haven. Unless the fight was really getting out of hand, and the Lock Haven fighter was taking a pretty good shellacking, and then Doc would have to interject. But Doc would always want to give you more range, but not because he was 65 years old and 300 pounds, and it was harder for him, you know, to get in the ropes, in the ring and everything. Stay on the back, and he would say, I want you to get in the ring, you know, get in the guy's face with the bucket, and if the fight, unless it's out of hand and I got to do the talking, I want you to do the talking. So I know there were times that I got in that ring, and I sat down with the fighter, and I said, you know what, here's what you got to do. You know, he's open for a counter right hand. Throws it back, wait a second, counter with your right hand, hook to the body. And that's how you learn. You can't learn unless you do it. But at the same time, I know training guys now, I have respect because not the fact that I was a collegiate All-American, but I survived a lot of those Philadelphia gym wars. So I can sit there and say, you know what, I got this in my back pocket. I can hold my hat on this. But those Philadelphia gym wars that people talk about all over the world, I had some Philadelphia gym wars that got standing ovations. So, yeah, I know what's like, and I know when somebody's hurt, and I know when a fight needs to be stopped and when a fighter needs to be motivated. Now, certain guys, I don't think would make good trainers. I don't think a guy like Roy Jones would make as good of a trainer because he was so unorthodox. And
right.
He kind of did things freestyling, where he was. I think Bernard Hopkins would make a better technical trainer because Bernard did so many things by the book, where guys like Roy Jones, Floyd Mayweather, I think Ali would have been a terrible trainer because he was so exceptionally good, he did everything wrong. I think a good guy like Buddy McGirt was a great, became a very good trainer because he did everything technically right during his career, and he was a technically proficient trainer, but then he was also compassionate to his fighters, but he was also a motivator too.
Okay, well, let's turn this on its head now, because maybe some ex-fighters could make worse trainers if they wouldn't understand who they're training and if they would try to mold them in the style that they had as fighters. You see my drift here with this. I think that as a trainer, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if someone's a slick boxer and they have good boxing skills, let's go with that. And if you were a brawler or a banger, you can't make them into that. Why would you try? And I think I'm sure that's happened. I mean, I can't think of any specifics off the top of my head.
I can. I'm sure you're going to remember this fighter, and I'm sure you're going to remember his son, who he trained, Smoking Joe Frazier. Smoking Joe, from the heart and the size of Philadelphia, he had a tremendous punch. If Joe was the one-handed puncher, I mean, he threw the hand to the body. Joe was a left-hook guy. That's what he beat you with. Now, his son, Marvis, was a better, technically skilled fighter. Marvis was a decent boxer. You know, quick hands, a little bit. He was taller than Joe, had a pretty good jab, not a big puncher. Why would you try to make Marvis into a replica of Joe Frazier?
How'd that work out?
Joe had more success with another fighter by the name of Bert Cooper, who took on the moniker of Smoking Bert Cooper because Bert Cooper was a pressure fighter. Now, he didn't have Joe's, I would say, unwieldy determination. Bert could get lazy at times. Bert sometimes wouldn't put the road work in. I had a friend of mine that grew up in the same neighborhood that used to see Bert sometimes jogging with a 40 of beer in his hand. So Bert did not have Joe's work ethic, and he didn't have his heart sometimes, but he had his similar style. So Joe was successful in training a guy like Bert Cooper. Training his own son, Marvis, not so much, because he tried to make Marvis into what he was, and that wasn't Marvis's forte.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there is an old mantra that if you can do, if you can't teach.
Yeah.
All right, so, but then let's look at that situation from last night. Now, Greg Jackson has a background in about everything, but I think by the time MMA started to get big, he was getting a little old and maybe just found his niche in the training world. And before we condemn him too much, I would question anyone questioning Greg, because results do speak for themselves. And he has produced some outstanding talent. And then you could say, well, it's a chicken and egg thing. Maybe did the talent migrate to him? I don't know. You could say that with John Jones maybe. But look who he's worked with and helped mold. It's almost a who's who.
Right. Well, with Greg Jackson, I think it's a little different story than most trainers, because he's not really the guy that does all the technical training. He has a whole camp for that. He's more of like a motivational speaker in the corner that tells the guy what he thinks, you know, from the overall perspective. But he's got Mike Winklejohn in there, who's the, you know, the primary boxing guy. And he has other experts that come into camp, and the fighters sort of sharpen themselves in a lot of situations too. But the thing that really stands out about Greg Jackson for me, as far as not having much of a fighting career or background himself, is when, I forget who he was fighting, but George St. Pierre came back to the corner and started complaining at one time about he had a torn groin muscle or something. And Greg Jackson basically told him, shut up, get out there and fight. And, you know, that takes somebody that has to be a little bit separated from the fight game, who hasn't been there in the first place, to really sympathize with the fighter. So in that sort of way, I guess it helps to not have the
Again, that's a very good point. That's you guys tickle my brain on this stuff. That's why I had to bring it up. I hadn't thought of that. But, yeah, so that really hit the nail on the head. Yeah.
But, you know, Greg Jackson, I don't know. I think the jury is still out on what his personal role is in terms of developing these fighters. I think he's more of a personality than a, you know, basically a playbook to get the best fight you can have.
Well, regardless, he has assembled the team, and I have to give him credit for that.
Right. But I think we're going to find out a lot about exactly what kind of coach he is during the season of the show. You know, we're kind of still getting through the selections here, so we really haven't seen exactly, you know, what we're going to get as far as, you know, how he motivates guys and how he actually brings people into his camp and what the camp is all about. Because all I know right now about Jackson is he works pretty much hand-in-hand with Winkleman. I don't know anything about any of the other guys in the camp except for the fighters themselves, and kind of listening to some of the stuff that John Jones and Bubba McDaniel had talked about in the last Ultimate Fighter. Pretty much where I got most of my inside knowledge of that camp. So it'd be interesting to see how that goes. And the one good thing about Fightmaster, too, is they do show a lot of repeats. So I was able to catch the last week's episode. They showed it a few times. I kept kind of catching it at the tail end, but I got a little bit more every time I saw a replay. So that was nice. They seem to be kind of going by the same schedule that Spike used to go by when the Ultimate Fighter was on. Another interesting article about MMA I had here is from a report out of a site called Fightnomics. And a guy named Reed Kuhn put together a chart that shows the decline of finishes in the UFC over the past 20 years, which may have something to do with coaching. When the promotion first started, the finish rate was a whopping 100%. However, throughout the years, that's dropped right in half to 50%. From 2008 to 2010, the UFC saw the biggest decline in finishes, but the rate stayed pretty consistent for the past 3 years. And, of course, part of the reason for the decline in finishes is the fighters playing it safe and doing just what it takes to win. But fighters are fighting less and less for the entertainment of the fans and more to stay on the roster and avoid losing their jobs. Something I brought up once in an article, I think it was back when I was doing a little writing for opposingviews.com. And my perspective back then was the bonus system and the mentality of you have to entertain or you have to win at all costs could affect the safety of some of these guys. But more so the bonus system, I thought. You're encouraging submissions and finishes which could injure guys rather than just letting these guys fight the fight. Fight of the night is one thing. And you're rewarding guys for trying to rip each other's arms off and knock each other out. It could be a situation where it endangers fighters a little more than they should be endangered. In a sport that's dangerous enough as it is. But regardless of all those conditions, it seems that only half of these fights left a year in the finishes.
That's a good point, though, about the early days. I remember the first and only World Combat Championship. Remember that one back in fall of 95? And I remember they had the announcers were commenting on the judging, and they said, "Well, I have two words to say about that." Yeah, right. And sure enough, I don't think any of those fights went to the judges. And the same with the early UFCs. I don't think I just can't think of any of them until probably UFC 5. Even then, it didn't. Shamrock and Gracie, I think that was just it was an agreed upon draw if it went 35 minutes. But yeah, I don't think we started seeing judging till the ultimate back in 95 when there were some judges. They had judging there. It was starting to change a bit. But yeah, those early ones, it was forget about the judges. 100. Well, I did 100% though. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, and one of the things that really seems to bother me when they throw people out too, guys like John Fitch are a perfect example, is first they try to make it look like, well, you got to win at all costs. If you lose three in a row, usually you're out. But then you've got situations where Fitch, who had been winning, and they still threw him out because he wasn't entertaining. This is not sports entertainment like wrestling. This is an actual fight in sport. So, I think, never mind the coaching, but when you got a guy who's managed and doesn't have any fighting experience, a guy who's president of a company has no fighting experience whatsoever. I mean, there's no record of him even having a sparring match. He was a boxing coach at one point, but I mean, we don't even have any footage of him sparring anybody ever. So, regardless of whether he did actually have a boxing match at one point, he's definitely never done MMA, but done some jiu-jitsu classes, of course, with the Fatigue stuff. I question sometimes how they can manage to keep him in power and to let him say all the stupid things he says about fighters when he has no experience himself and he can't really relate. But, he continues to cut people. We got another story here about 6 more fighters cut from the roster. Eddie Mendez, Roger Hollis, Anthony Smith, Nashon Barrow, and Carlos Vemola, and Leandro Silva all were cut from this week. And you have situations where there's a double standard, too. Guys like Dan Hardy lost 4 in a row. Granted, there were a lot of tough opponents in that 4, just the 4, but he didn't get thrown. He's still on the roster. He doesn't even know if he's going to fight again. He's still a UFC fighter. He's got some kind of heart issue. And hasn't been released. He hasn't fought forever either. So they kind of pick and choose the people that they'd like to keep around and the people that they throw out. It just blows my mind sometimes when I think that this organization is the top dog in the world and it's setting the standards of behavior like that. But what can you do? They're the top dog. They pretty much get the spoils. So the winner goes to spoils, right? that's pretty much all the major news stories I've collected here. You guys got any? Well, actually, got one more. Of course, we haven't mentioned anything about performance-enhancing drugs in this episode. So we're going to have our token PED story. And this one happens to be from women's MMA. And it's actually from a particularly hot woman. You could actually call her Damn Hot because her name is Karina Dam. D-A-M-M, Karina Dam. She's been fined at $550 and suspended 6 months by the Ohio Athletic Commission for submitting a urine sample that wasn't actually urine. And she's been called the Barbie of women's MMA. And she lost to Jessica Eye, which seems to actually be a very familiar refrain scenario that unfolds after these people get pops for positive tests. They always seem to lose their fights. So it kind of defeats the purpose of using some kind of illegal substance. But in this case, she wasn't actually busted for the substance. She was busted because her urine sample was not urine. And even the doctor, when he first handed the sample to the commissioner, said, "I'm not a lab person, but 2 things here. 1, this is kind of clear, and 2, it's cold." She didn't even bother to put it in the microwave before she gave it up. But she's 34 years old. She plans on appealing the suspension for some reason, which might be a tough sell since she was the first female MMA fighter to ever be suspended in the United States for steroid use back in 2008. And she tested positive at that point for an elevated level of the anabolic steroid mandrolone after a win. Whoops, one win, I guess, in the history of PED users. She won with Sophia Bagardine at Fatal Femmes Fighting 4. At the time, she was fined $2,500 and suspended for a year by the California State Athletic Commission. Usually, past transgressions affect appeals situations in the case.
Yeah, there was an interesting thread on the Underground about that, and a lot of wise guy comments like, "Well, I'll be damned," and "Damn," you know, that just kept coming up. You know, that's pun intended.
Well, in her case, I guess she has quite a career ahead of her as a model. She doesn't stay in MMA. She's actually already appeared in the Japanese version of Playboy, which doesn't say much because they actually make you pose clothed in the Japanese version of Playboy.
Okay. Yeah, they just buy them for the articles, right? Right.
Yeah, they really do. we'll see. I don't know if she has much of a chance of being granted that appeal. But I guess that does it for us, unless you guys have anything else to add.
Well, I got one thing to add that you guys are going to kick out of this. You know what I almost agreed to do today?
What?
Sit ringside at an MMA show.
Oh, really? How did that go?
Well, here's how it happened. I was at the fitness center today working out. They're my one friend. And so I was just there. They had the one room open for like 15 minutes, just enough time for me to go in there and do a couple rounds of skipping rope. So I'm in there just finishing my rope skipping. And as I was walking out, this one girl was walking in. And I talked to her from time to time. And she is an employee at the casino that Tom and I were at a couple weeks ago as a drink server. Well, she was off that night, but she told me, she was, "Oh, my God, how were the fights?" And I'm like, "Oh, seriously, you're actually really talking to me this time?" I'm like, "Okay." So I'm bullshitting with her a little bit, and she's like, "Yeah, it's like, do they have MMA cards?" So I'm like, "Yeah, I usually don't go to that." She's, "Yeah, the last one, somebody gave me 6 front row tickets, and I was only able to use 4 of them." And I'm like, "Well, you know what? Next time, you give me a call, I'll go."
Right.
I mean, I won't watch the fight. I mean, literally, I'll send you Rich in a report, which obviously you know I'll know nothing about what the hell I'm writing about. But I'll also be looking at the girl the whole time. I'm rotten. You guys know that.
All in good fun. Alrighty, well, before we do go, I would like to play a funny clip that I sent you guys already as a going-away present for our viewers, our listeners. And it was Rosie Perez on the Craig Ferguson, the Late Show with Craig Ferguson there, talking about boxing.
You know that, right?
What?
That's Iceman John Scully's girl.
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention that, too. That would be your first clue that she's a boxing fan. If you subscribe to his feed there, you see that he has a picture taken with her. He met her in New York, and he was very thrilled. I think at the time he told her that he was one of the white men who could jump. Because of her white man can't jump really experience. But I always remember her better for the role on one of Spike Lee's first movies, Do the Right Thing, and Mookie's Girlfriend. And I don't know if she's had any surgery since then, but she was, I think, she had a full knee scene in that one. So Ferguson made a couple of jokes about her looks Here's the thing. Thank you.